Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Gorfine Schiller and Garden podcast series. Today we're speaking with Scott Rogeville, an officer at Gorfine Schiller and Garden, about the multiple fiduciary responsibilities for nonprofits and much more. And Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Matt. How about yourself?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us once again. And let's kick it off. If you don't mind, give us a high-level overview of the fiduciary duties of nonprofits these days.
Sure. So every board member in a nonprofit has a responsibility to execute and carry out their fiduciary responsibilities. And specifically, when we talk about them, we're talking about three major duties. One is duty of care, the second is duty of loyalty, and the third is duty of obedience. When you're talking to board members about their duty of care, we're always careful to talk about them in terms of how they're participating in the organization. Are they actively participating? That means, are they involved in decision-making at the appropriate level? Are they attending meetings? Do they understand the industry in which they're operating? Have they provided strategic direction for the organization where appropriate? And overall, are they overseeing management? Because there are boards that go through various cycles, this duty of care means different things at different points to different people and in different organizations. So you have to pay attention to all those details before you can really answer for yourself. When we move on and look at the duty of loyalty, that's a pretty common sense requirement under the fiduciary responsibilities for board members. And that's basically that you're operating the organization first in the interest of the nonprofit and not to position yourself or further your own personal agenda. And that's important, and it's something that, of course, the public looks at when they look at it on organizations 990 or other public disclosures that may be made. And so it's really all about how you carry yourself. And then lastly, the duty of obedience, the third of our three pillars, requires the board to know the applicable state and federal laws and regulations that apply to the organization. At the state level, that might mean knowing where and when you have to apply and register as an exempt organization. At the federal level, it means making sure that you comply with all the guidelines and make sure that the organization is completing its annual reporting requirements, which at the federal level include the IRS Form 990 or 990EZ. And at the state level, it may be an annual registration, but it's important to understand the jurisdictions in which the organization's operating. It's also important when doing this to not necessarily overstep the board member's responsibility. Because not every organization's in the same place, some organizations may have sufficient structure internally to identify these requirements and report back to the board, where in other cases, the board members are almost expected to know the rules and help the staff to fulfill their obligation under those rules. Along those same lines of your duty of obedience, you have to understand the organization's independent operating documents, bylaws, articles of incorporation, and to be sure that you're not acting outside of the scope of those documents.
Okay, great. Now, if you don't mind, give us some insights into kind of the board process, too.
Board process is governed in large part by the bylaws of the organization and its articles of incorporation. They tell us how many officers there are, what their titles are, what their responsibilities are, and they lead us down the road of how frequently they should be elected, for what length of term, are there term limits, how often they might have meetings. Sometimes it's laid out in the bylaws of an organization. You need to know that. You need to be familiar as an officer or board member with a nonprofit organization. You need to be intimately familiar with those bylaws because they govern your process. And that process includes, like I said, the frequency of elections and meetings, but it also lays out the responsibilities for certain officers on the board. And knowing all of these attributes contained within the bylaws gives you an opportunity to be successful. And to me, success is understanding the process for changing those documents as much as it is adhering to those documents. But it also leads to what I think is one of the most important features of any quality nonprofit organization, and that's transparency. And transparency means that the people to whom you're serving understand how you do things and that they're comfortable, hopefully, with the process by which you do them. It means that potential donors, your stakeholders, understand the organization, how it operates. It doesn't mean that they're making decisions for the organization, but it means that the decisions that the organization is making to carrying out its exempt purpose are easily visible and therefore, generally speaking, create a comfort level for donors to contribute their personal assets to the organization's well-meaning mission. When it comes to the election process for your organization's board members, understanding how the governance committee and most organizations operate with a governance committee understanding how it should process, how it should function in terms of nominations, in terms of renominations for existing board members, and being able to deal with the tough questions of, I've got a board member who served now for 25 years. Do you think I still need him? Do you think he still adds value to the organization? Finding ways to avoid being in that difficult position is an effective way of using the organization's governing documents in a transparent fashion. When we look at board meetings for your organization, what governs them? Many organizations, both for-profit as well as not-for-profit, allow Robert's Rules to govern their meetings. It's important to understand Robert's Rules. It's important to have a board chair or a parliamentarian who's familiar with them so that there's a sense of order for the process within a meeting. Having that order provides an environment where all members can be heard, and their voices can be listened to and respected, and nobody's position is put down, because it's important when you're running a diverse and inclusive board that all persons have an opportunity to be heard. Along those lines, you look at the responsibilities of those board members. The most important one to me is to operate in a transparent manner. You want to be above reproach from outsiders. You want the IRS to know exactly what you're doing. If you're involved in outside organizations like we have here in Maryland with the Maryland Association of Nonprofit Organizations, who executes a program called Standards for Excellence, transparency is at the very top of their list, and they're going to want to see every document that you put together to ensure that you are, in fact, operating transparently.
That's great. And, you know, I think my next question probably plays very well into this, especially when it comes to transparency. But if you don't mind, give us a quick overview of all the financial reporting responsibilities for nonprofits.
Certainly. So, Matt, it's important to understand the jurisdiction in which you're operating. We're a Maryland-based firm, and while we do serve organizations outside of Maryland, I'm going to speak specifically with those rules that apply to most Maryland nonprofit organizations. So first and foremost, as I touched on earlier, most nonprofits, if not all, are required to report to the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS has an annual reporting requirement known as a Form 990. It's an annual return for exempt organizations. And depending upon the volume of activity that you're doing, you'll either report on a Form 990 if you're a large organization, generally based on revenues in excess of $250,000 a year, or you'll be a smaller organization that would report on a Form 990EZ, which is generally your annual gross receipts are less than the $250,000 but more than $25,000 annually. If you're under $25,000, then you would complete what's called an e-postcard or Form 990N. Very simple form. Anybody within the organization can generally complete it in less than 10 minutes. Now, speaking to the larger organizations and the medium-sized organizations, state requirements are different. In the state of Maryland, if you are what's considered a larger organization where your contributions are greater than $750,000, there's a requirement that you get an audit done of your financial statements from an independent CPA. So if you're above that threshold, you have to fulfill that obligation, and you have to annually renew with the Secretary of State for the state of Maryland your charity position and present to them a copy of your 990 and audited financial statements. If you're a slightly smaller organization, less than $750,000, but more than $250,000, then you're going to report to the Secretary of State, and you're going to be required to submit a reviewed financial statement in addition to your Form 990 or 990EZ. If you're less than $250,000, then there's still a requirement to report to and register with the Secretary of State's office, but the only thing that you'll have to submit is a copy of your information return or your tax return, your Form 990. This doesn't necessarily make the beginning or the end of your reporting requirements. Many nonprofit organizations today get their funding from individual grantors that contribute a large amount, or they might be getting them from state or local jurisdiction government agencies that might also have their own separate audit requirement. And they might even be at different thresholds than those required by the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's focus is charitable contributions. In many cases, your funding for program services may not be considered charitable contributions, and it may put you not in the Secretary of State's requirement for an audit, but rather at the jurisdictional level based on the contract, or maybe even a private foundation that's funding a significant amount of your organization's operations. That gives you a little bit of an idea of what some of the reporting responsibilities are for most nonprofit organizations.
That's great, Scott. Thanks for those insights there. And let's switch real quick and talk about technologies. What are the technologies that are out there that can be leveraged from a fiduciary standpoint?
So, Matt, it's a great question, because technology obviously is playing a major role in business today, and We always try to remember that nonprofit organizations are still businesses, and so they should look to opportunities to take advantage of that technology. And it varies, and for board members, their role in understanding that technology is more at the 100,000-foot level in most organizations. But when you've got a small nonprofit with maybe one staff or one half a staff, board members need to know more of the technology aspects in the details than you might otherwise think. But looking at it from the 100,000-foot level, it's important for board members to understand how is the organization leveraging technology for its benefit. How are they using fundraising software to track donors and maintain their donor database? How are they using accounting software to maintain the records of the organization? How generally is the organization staff correlating between the donor software and the organization's accounting software? Not that they should be in the details of it, but that they should conceptually understand what the organization is doing functionally. To take it a step further, most organizations have some sort of presence in the Internet. Well, as a board member, you should periodically visit the organization's website to make sure that you understand the content that's there, the nature of the requests for donations that might be there, the information that generally is available to the public and that the public is using. Does the organization take advantage of the technology that's available to distribute its financial statements or Form 990 through its website? That's a strategic decision, and that may be one that is good conversation at a board meeting with the organization's CEO if you're not currently using that opportunity to get the word out. Remember that those documents are as much compliance as they are marketing opportunities. When you prepare them, or when the staff prepares them, or if your outside accountant is preparing them, you want to make sure that they tell the story that the organization wants heard by the public. And more importantly, if they're telling a great story, use the technology available to post them to the Internet, to get them out there so that people can easily access information. This goes back to my earlier discussion regarding the responsibility for care and make sure that the organization's transparent. Here's another opportunity to show how transparent you are by posting your financial statement. Technology doesn't stop there, however, Matt, because we've got other things that we need to look at. In today's world, we've got organizations that run small, little activities, fundraising activities, and they may be using items like the Square and other similar products to collect revenue. Well, as a board member, you should be aware of it. You should know some of the dangers of identity theft and similar issues and make sure that the organization is considering it. And I don't mean, once again, that board members should overstep their position and get into tactics, but they should make sure that they're asking the question of their leadership, their staff leadership, what are you doing to protect us using this technology? Lastly, in this area, Matt, the final kind of warning is the most dangerous technology that we have out there is social media. Board members should feel comfortable that the way it's being used by the organization properly represents how they want to be seen by the public. That doesn't mean that they should be specifically controlling a Facebook account or a Twitter account or monitoring every single tweet, but they generally should make sure that there's a policy in place that ensures that the organization's staff is properly using those devices, those resources, in order to advance the mission and accomplish the worthy goal of that nonprofit organization.
That's great. And you know, Scott, this is a perfect segue to my next question, because you're talking about the dangers of technologies. And let's focus on kind of a bigger picture in terms of the entire threat landscape for nonprofits. What's it like out there in terms of this landscape?
So, Matt, it's kind of a scary place for nonprofits. Money is tight in this economy. We see that the stock market goes up every day, it seems, to record numbers for the better part of the last few months. But at the same time, in my experiences, I don't see where charitable contributions are rising. And to make matters worse, I think that the new tax laws represent a potential threat to core revenue sources for those organizations. Because of the raising of the standard deduction for most individuals, particularly married folks, and the limitation on state and local tax deductions, all of a sudden we have a new threat to charitable contributions. It's not necessarily going to be as profitable for people from a tax perspective to make donations, and so it's important that organizations do everything they can in order to generate mission-connected donations. So in doing so, they have to look at the political environment that's out there, the economic environment, and then the cyber threat environment. And those are what I perceive to be the biggest three targets on our threat landscape today. The political is, as I touched on, what's the impact on taxes for us? How could that affect charitable contributions? What other changes are out there? As we witnessed a couple years ago with Planned Parenthood, you can get caught in the middle of a political tornado that you had no interest in being a part of. But nevertheless, as an officer or a board member of the organization, you need to be paying attention to the industries that that organization is operating in. And you need to be having those conversations with your executive director and CEO to make sure that they understand the landscape and that they're being proactive in protecting the organization and its board members in that process. In the economic environment, you know, I talked about taxes. I talked about just generally the ability to raise funds and the difficulty involved in that. And so you need to be paying attention to how are you managing endowments? Are you executing proper fiduciary responsibilities over the endowment that you're responsible for? Are you paying attention to budgets? Again, board members want to be careful not to overplay their position in the budget process, but they do have a fiduciary responsibility to oversee it. Make sure that management is using good assumptions in developing their budget, that the numbers are reasonable, and that they're monitoring throughout the year so that if revenue forecasts are not the same as the actual revenues being earned, that if it's necessary to make adjustments to the budget, that the board is aware of it and that they're participating in the process as appropriate. Lastly, cyber threats. We see every day, it feels like, a story in the news where some big company has been hacked and that there's been a data breach. You, as a board member, need to be aware of what the organization is using out in the public space and how it's protecting itself from outsiders. Is it receiving donor information? And if it is, how is it being stored? How is it accessible? Is it a threat because it's being stored in the cloud? And what's your cloud provider doing? Again, I warn you not to overstep your bounds into management's responsibility, but the important thing here is that you're aware of what the potential issues are and that you're supporting management in terms of how they're resolving those issues and trying to reduce as much as possible the risk that's there to the organization.
Got it. Perfect. Great summary there. Certainly lots of threats. And you know, my next question doesn't necessarily tie into it, but I think it's very timely with this podcast. You recently authored a guest article in Nonprofit Pro magazine about how nonprofits should really view themselves not as being nonprofits, but as being tax-exempt organizations. Tell us a little bit more about this concept.
Matt, thanks for bringing up the article. I think it's really relevant and really timely and connects well here. I mentioned earlier that nonprofit organizations are businesses. And sometimes I feel, and this was the tone of the article, that nonprofits don't think of themselves as businesses. And I feel very strongly, that they really need to think of themselves first as tax-exempt organizations. They're tax-exempt, which means that there's no limitation on their ability to earn income. And in fact, I recommend that they earn income because of all the threats that I've outlined in our prior discussion about the threat environment, all of those things can cost an organization significant dollars. The need to change or pivot an organization's approach to business is important. And if they think of themselves as a nonprofit as opposed to a tax-exempt organization, I think that they put themselves in a more vulnerable position because they're not necessarily trying to budget to put money away. Now, I work with a lot of different nonprofits in a lot of different industries within the nonprofit space, and I find that the ones that think of themselves more as a business, as just a tax-exempt organization with a great mission, that they are looking at ways to budget money to the bottom line, that they're trying to not just hoard money, because I don't encourage that, but to put money away so that they can make future investments in new programs, so that they can raise capital against the capital that they're holding, so that they can make larger investments in their current programs. If they need to acquire a building, that they're not always in this campaign mode. And I think that when I observe behaviors in the clients that I have and the organizations I see, that when they're constantly in that campaign mode, their donors get weary of it. And so if they're doing a better job of finding a way to take 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 15% even of their gross revenues and move them into their endowments and start to build a little bit, it's not always the easiest argument with donors because they want to see your spending, but it's also you're being a responsible business person in an organization that is really trying to drive enough profits to be able to provide the service it desires. Whether you're raising money for research for science, or you're raising money to provide services today for disabled individuals, or you're raising money for the arts, you will always have the need to have more than what's available to you. And to the extent that you can run a budget and a business where you're actually thinking of it in terms of trying to make a little bit of profit so that you can save it for future investment, that's what every other business does. So think of yourself as a tax-exempt organization.
That's fantastic. You know, Scott, we've covered off on a lot of things today. Is there anything else to add? Anything we may have missed?
I guess the one last thought I'll throw in there, because I always think that this is of value to my clients, and we always talk about it, is that one of the flaws right now that I see in our government at the state level and at the federal level, I can attribute to term limits. And so when you're a tax-exempt or a nonprofit organization, I recommend that you think about your board relative to the idea of term limits. It's never easy to say goodbye to people who've been loyal to an organization, and you never want to really say goodbye. You just want to transition them to a different role within the organization. And so I strongly encourage any organization that's operating without term limits to give serious consideration to reasonable term limits, because it will help to create new people involved in your organization and prevent the board from becoming stagnant. It'll help to continue to bring new ideas and new energy to an organization whose mission is to serve the general public. And I think that can't be of enough value to you.
That's excellent. What a perfect way to end this interview. For all of our listeners, you just heard an exclusive Gorfine, Schiller & Garden podcast interview with Scott Rogeville, who's an officer at the firm. And Scott was kind enough to share his insights on the multiple fiduciary responsibilities for nonprofits, why they need to view themselves as being tax-exempt organizations, and much more. And Scott, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Matt. I really appreciate it.